Let's do it here.
All right.
1320 WILS. I'm Michael Cohen. Great to have you here. Well, it's getting bigger by the day. In fact, now it's in the billions of dollars. It's Bitcoin. I'm sure you've heard all about it, but you may not know exactly what it is. Brian Patrick Iha is with us, a technology journalist and the author of the new book, How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance. Brian, it is great to have you on 1320 WILS.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
You know, I've never used Bitcoin myself. Have you?
Yes. When I was, researching and reporting the book, I had to get some digital currency and kind of store it in a digital wallet, buy and sell just a bit of it because I wanted to see what it was like to use these services and see what it was like to kind of transmit, from one person to another.
And what can you give me an example? What do you do with Bitcoin once you actually have some?
Well, it helps, I think, to start by kind of defining what it is. And in the simplest terms, Bitcoin is really a form of commodity money. When it was released in January 2009, originally its promise was to be a truly universal currency, a form of electronic cash that could be sent around the globe in minutes, and it would work, as well in New York as it does in New Delhi. And the transactions would take place on a network that existed independently of any government or bank or payments company like PayPal. Mm-hmm. And so Bitcoin can serve as a unit of exchange. That's kind of the term economists use, something with which you buy a plane ticket or a pair of shoes, or it can serve as a store of value like gold. So some people call it digital gold. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the double meaning in the term commodity money.
Yeah.
And then it also has this revolutionary payment system that allows you to send money directly from person to person in minutes anywhere in the world.
So if you were to want to get Bitcoin, where would you go to get some?
Well, there are these online exchanges all over the world where you can you sign up, you create an account, you verify your identity. And most of them, especially the ones based in the U.S., they have to kind of follow some of the financial regulations that require them to know who their customers are and so on to prevent money laundering. But once you're on there, you maybe do a wire transfer from your checking account or some other kind of way of getting the funds in. And then from there, you have access to this whole world of digital assets like Bitcoin. And you simply, buy it at the market price. Or you can, on some of these exchanges, do a little more sophisticated trading. You can say you want to buy it when the price, falls down to a certain point or goes up to a certain point. So those exchanges, some of them get pretty sophisticated. They're almost a little bit like a stock market or something.
Right.
And then there are more simple ways to do it. Like there are these devices called Bitcoin ATMs or BTMs, which really look a lot like an ATM kiosk. And you kind of walk up to them and you can, put in cash and stuff and get Bitcoins into a digital wallet in exchange.
Where are we now? I mean, where is the price of Bitcoin? I know it was fluctuating there for a while.
Oh, yeah. So right now it's above $2,500 for a single Bitcoin.
Jeez.
And the market cap, I think, is somewhere around $40 billion or $42 billion.
$2,500 for one. And let's say 5 years ago, what was the value of a Bitcoin?
About? Oh, boy. 5 years ago, we're talking 2012. So that's actually the summer of 2012 is when I wrote about Bitcoin for the first time as a journalist. And I'll never forget, I was a staff writer at CNN Money. And when I pitched this story to my editor, she said, you can go ahead and do it, but just don't make too much of it. She said Bitcoin is basically just this plaything, on the internet. It's like this digital curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the price of a single Bitcoin was less than $10, and all the Bitcoins in existence put together were worth only $96 million.
Amazing.
But as I said, now it's, $2,500, and the market cap is like $40 billion. So I think I made the right choice to take it seriously.
Brian Patrick Iha with us. His book is How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance. What is the consequence of Bitcoin? What is it really going to do to our financial system?
Well, there are a number of consequences it's already had. One of them is that we never had a way before to send money peer-to-peer, person-to-person, without having to go through a middleman like a bank or payments company. And that means that Bitcoin is what they call censorship resistant. That means that, you know, a government can't prevent you from sending money to someone else. So if you are, you know, let's say you're a Cuban American living in Miami and you have a grandmother who's back in Havana and, you know, the economy there is not so great and she's living under the Castro regime and you want to send her some money. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, perhaps it'd be difficult for her in Cuba to exchange, you know, bitcoins into Cuban pesos or something. But you could actually do that. You'd be able to send her money directly and neither the Castros, you know, or Trump or anyone could prevent you from doing that. A few years ago, when U.S. banks and payments companies were blockading WikiLeaks because of, you know, some of the revelations they had made about the government and PayPal and banks were not allowing people to give, you know, make donations to WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks started accepting Bitcoin donations and people were able to give them money without, you know, anyone being able to prevent it. Yeah. And whatever you think of WikiLeaks as an organization itself, especially nowadays, you know, that's kind of a tremendously valuable thing.
But I should note, I just saw the story that there's been a rift now within the Bitcoin community, and this group of investors want to start this thing called Bitcoin Cash. Well, what's happening within the community in general then?
Well, so that gets, you know, we were kind of, you know, doing some of the Bitcoin 101 and 102 type questions, and that's kind of like the graduate level seminar in Bitcoin to talk about. But no, I'll try to answer your question. So for over a year now, there's been some debate among stakeholders in the Bitcoin community about how to kind of upgrade the software to meet the growing demands of its global user base. You know, there's some limitations right now in the software that might hold it back in terms of, you know, really serving a huge global user base. And I will say a report out of Cambridge University this past April found that the number of cryptocurrency users worldwide already rivals the population of small countries. So it's pretty impressive already, but for it to continue growing, people seem to agree that there needs to be an upgrade to the software. The problem is there are different competing proposals for how to do that. And then there are different, you know, each one has its partisans. Mm-hmm. And there are some people saying that, you know, different ones might have different drawbacks and so on. And, you know, that's really kind of what's taking place at the moment.
So, I mean, but is there going to be some trouble ahead?
Well, you know, some people have feared that, but I think actually there will be some consensus that's reached in the near future, and I do think Bitcoin is going to continue growing successfully.
So is the idea that Bitcoin is going to somehow replace the currency we were using in general, or?
No, I don't think it's going to replace the U.S. dollar and the British pound and so on, at least not anytime soon. But, you know, it is able to serve as this universal currency, this form of borderless money that doesn't have to be exchanged from one into the other when you go from place to place. And in fact, in my book, you know, my book is not by any means a textbook or how-to manual. It's really a deeply reported character-driven narrative in which we follow this small cast of kind of brilliant pioneers as they, you know, work to build the future of finance. And we follow their trials and triumphs kind of like, you know, in a book like The Big Short by Michael Lewis. Mm-hmm. And I say that because one of the characters in the book, it's pretty fascinating. He ends up traveling the world in his capacity as CEO of a Bitcoin startup. And he's got a digital wallet on his phone that holds a balance of Bitcoins for him. And he finds restaurants in Paris and other places that accept Bitcoins as a form of money. Mm-hmm. And he's able to just kind of live this, you know, almost more frictionless existence, traveling from place to place and kind of having this money that comes with him wherever he goes or is accessible from wherever he goes. And, you know, one of the things I think we're going to start to see Bitcoin fulfill some of the predictions that these early pioneers made for it years ago. Mm-hmm. One of those has to do with remittances. So you might know that like 2 billion adults in the world today don't have a bank account. We think of, you know, in the United States, we're pretty lucky. We don't think about that stuff very often. But even some people in the United States are what they call the unbanked or underbanked. They don't have access to traditional financial services. Mm-hmm. They don't have access to credit and so on. And this means these people can't participate in the global economy.
Right. And I should note that we hear a lot about this effort to have cashless societies, right? We see what's happening in India, and apparently there's an effort here in the U.S. at some point to do this. How does the Bitcoin technology fit into that?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly kind of driving that forward. A lot of central banks and others have actually, you know, it's interesting because Bitcoin was created to kind of get around central bank policies of, you know, inflating their currencies and governments determining who you could send money to and things like that. But their existence in the world has kind of changed the way that a lot of people are thinking about money and value in a fundamental way. And so, yeah, I mean, I do think that Bitcoin has a role to play in these the future of societies if they go cashless. I was going to say that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
I was going to say, has there been a reaction from governments in general to try to somehow shut Bitcoin down or fight against it somehow?
Well, there are, you know, certainly some, you know, law enforcement agencies have gone after bad actors in the space, as they would any, you know, criminals who were using cash or any other form of money. And certainly U.S. regulators on the state level and the federal level have made various determinations about, you know, how Bitcoin should be taxed and how, you know, Bitcoin companies should be regulated and things like that. And so, you know, it's definitely a mistaken idea that some people have that, like, these things are not regulated at all, or that it's a total Wild West. That's not really true anymore. Mm-hmm. But I do think we're well past the point of governments trying to just ban it outright or shut it down. You know, and one of the reasons is we live in a globalized world, and the U.S. is very aware that, I mean, for instance, China is very big on Bitcoin, and Japan just this past April officially declared that Bitcoin is legal tender in Japan, which is the world's third largest economy. And I think the U.S. is very aware that if they were to try to ban Bitcoin, not only would that perhaps be something of a fool's errand, but at the very least, it would drive all the innovations surrounding these technologies to other countries, you know, and that's just something the U.S. can't really afford to do and wouldn't want to do.
It's Brian Patrick Iha with us. His brand new book is How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance. He said 5 years ago it was $10 for a Bitcoin. Now it's $2,500. Is this?
Right.
Do you anticipate this exponential growth to continue?
I think, you know, it's always dangerous to put yourself in the position of being Nostradamus and make predictions, especially as a journalist. But My sense is that, yes, the price is going to continue to grow over time. It was pointed out to me that, one of the things that makes Bitcoin interesting as a form of money is that there's actually a hard limit on the number that will ever be created. That number is 21 million, and most of those have already been created. There are about 17 or 18 million in existence today. Mm-hmm. The number of new ones being created happens at a regular rate, but that rate is predetermined to slow down over time. At any rate, the point is that there are not even enough Bitcoins to go around for all the millionaires in the U.S. to have just one Bitcoin apiece, and that's just in the U.S. And so, you know, one Bitcoin is divisible down to 8 decimal places. Because it's a form of electronic money, you can split it up into very small parts. But when we talk about a whole Bitcoin being worth $2,500, you know, there are not even enough of those for just every millionaire in the United States to have a single one. And right now, anyone could go online and buy one for $2,500. But, you know, in the future, it might be the case that only, you know, the very wealthy or the people who got in really early and just kind of held on to their assets are, you know, to have a whole Bitcoin might be considered crazy, almost like saying you have like 10 pounds of gold or something.
Do we know how Bitcoins are used typically for the what kinds of transactions most account for most of the use of Bitcoin?
Well, there's e-commerce uses for Bitcoin. There are online retailers like the electronics retailer Tiger Direct, like Overstock.com, and others which accept Bitcoin as payment. I believe the website Cheap Air a few years ago began accepting Bitcoin to let people buy plane tickets and so on. That's part of it. Another part of it is for remittances and other cross-border payments. So this is the practice of immigrants sending money, you know, back to their families.
Mm-hmm.
And $600 billion of remittances flow around the world every year. And in my book, one character predicts that Bitcoin is going to do to Western Union and MoneyGram what Netflix did to Blockbuster.
Wow.
That basically these services people use to send money, you know, back to their loved ones, they charge these really high extortionate fees, and Bitcoin would be a way to do that faster and more cheaply. So there are companies that are providing those services today. And then others, you know, of course, there is some kind of underground or criminal use of Bitcoin on the dark web.
Do we know any idea of how extensive that is right now?
I was told a couple of months ago by a researcher that amounts to about a $500 million a year market or industry. But, you know, Bitcoin's whole market cap is, as I said, about $40 billion or more right now. And, you know, $1 billion or more worth of it changes hands every day, I believe. So certainly when you look at all the cryptocurrencies, some of which have, you know, been created, have been inspired by Bitcoin, more than $1 billion of this stuff changes hands every day. So the criminal use of it is only a small portion of the total Bitcoin economy, I guess, is the point I would make.
It's Brian Patrick Iha, technology journalist and author of How Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance. Brian Patrick Iha, right here on 1320 WILS. Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Brian, thanks again. I think people are going to find this very interesting. This will be definitely new information.